thank you all for coming in the imminence of the snowstorm. Appreciate your making your way through the winter tonight. The whole question of what is supernatural and what isn't can be illustrated by a couple of stories that I'd like to tell you, both of which happened to me, so I know they were true, even if you don't necessarily know they were true yourself. This first one happened around 1991. At the time, I was writing an article on Native American spirituality for Yoga Journal magazine, which some of you may have seen. And I decided I needed to do a little bit of field work. So I went to see a medicine man in Nevada named Rolling Thunder, who was in his day quite well known. I was living in San Francisco at the time. And I spent a few days with him, which were quite interesting. And as I was getting ready to leave, he had one of his people come and give a little tobacco blessing for my car. You know, he basically offered some tobacco to the six directions and blessed my car. And I thought, well, this is all very nice, and didn't think much more of it. But I was driving home over Interstate 80, for those of you who know the state of California, over the Donner Summit. And a really peculiar thing happened. I was going fairly fast, and I was in the fast lane. And right behind me suddenly pulls up a red sports car on my tail. You know, who likes that? I'll just pull over, you know, to the other lane and let him go. Well, as I did that, for some inexplicable reason, a sudden storm descended on us. And there was ice falling and snow within like a few seconds. It had been cloudy, but there hadn't been anything else. And I looked in my rear mirror and I saw the red sports car go through a guardrail and crash down to what must have been very, 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 very far below. I got off at the next exit, and fortunately there was a fire station there, and I told them about that. I didn't go back or stay to see what happened to the red sports car. I figured the emergency people were going to take care of it as well as they could. But it had a slightly uncanny quality to me about it. So that's one story. The other happened to me, would have been in 2003. At the time, I was living in Massachusetts, and I moved to a little house I'd rented just for myself. And I was there three or four nights. I was living alone. And as I was asleep in my bedroom, I felt someone poking me on the shoulder. Then I woke up, and in some kind of strange hypnagogic state, I saw what looked like a 12-year-old boy standing in the corner of the bedroom. And, you know, I blinked my eyes a couple of times, and it was gone, and partly because I made it go. But it's, again, had a rather uncanny quality to it. I lived in that house for 5 years, and although I was very comfortable there, I always had a sense that there was some kind of presence of some sort or another. But it was mostly benign. It was entirely benign. And once I remember I'd gone to bed, and I decided to get up and go into the living room to get a book or something. And you know, as I went in the living room, the light helpfully went on. So you know, it was obviously a well-intentioned whatever it was. And I guess I tell these two stories as a way of illustrating some of the issues that arise around the supernatural as we come to explore it. Now, in the first case, everything I said in terms of the driving the car and having it blessed and seeing the sports car go off the road, There was nothing paranormal about it. Everything, you know, had a perfectly good, solid explanation. I happened to pull over just at the right time when the storm descended, and the sports car was not so lucky, or the guy in the sports car was not so lucky. Everything there has a perfectly rational explanation to it. Did anything paranormal happen? No, not really. But it certainly felt as if something did. In the second case, did anything paranormal happen? Well, there were certainly no witnesses, because I was the only person in the house. You know, a skeptic might argue, well, you just had an unusually vivid dream and it woke you up and that was that. It certainly didn't feel that way, because like you, I imagine I'd been awakened by dreams various times and it didn't really feel that way. So I guess I would say that there are two aspects of what one might call the supernatural. One is where, in a way, nothing unusual has happened. No laws of physics are violated. In the other, yeah, you start to, you know, you're starting to see things that aren't there. You're starting to have some encounter with what looks like another reality. And one of the things I'm trying to suggest in the book that I've written is that the supernatural has that quality about it. And it's as if you can't really deal with these kinds of things without taking that into account. There's always something very curious about these kinds of subjects, because the minute you start to believe in this stuff, so to speak, you know, you kind of get disappointed here and there, and you're like, well, I don't know, maybe it really isn't. And just at the point where you decide, oh, this is all nonsense, something tugs at your sleeve and indicates to you, well, there may be something in it after all. It occupies what's sometimes called a liminal space. And liminal means, it comes from a Latin word meaning threshold. You're sort of always on this threshold, you know, that in a sense Rod Serling captured very well in The Twilight Zone. I occasionally see reruns of The Twilight Zone on, they're still on there. They seem remarkably formulaic for the most part, you know. Man goes back in time, man is catapulted forward in time, you know. They don't seem quite as fresh as they probably did in, you know, 1962. Nonetheless, the whole show captured that kind of weird mood where, in a sense, anything could happen. And once in a while, things slip into that category of the paranormal or supernatural, apparently. It's difficult to pin it down scientifically because all of these events are one-off experiences. How do you replicate a one-off experience? Well, you really don't. And I think a lot of skeptics, professional skeptics, make the big mistake of saying, well, because it's not replicable, you know, it must not have happened. Well, actually, there's a lot in human experience that isn't replicable. History is not replicable, right? You can't carry out another World War II, fortunately. But the skeptics tend not to pay too much attention to this. And when I use the word skeptic, I mean it in a very specific sense. Really, skeptic means someone who's inquiring. More and more, it's come to denote a dogmatic position. That is to say, you're skeptical of all of this stuff, but you're not really skeptical because you know the answer. You know that it's all bunk. And that's not really being skeptical, because it's not really wanting to know the truth. It's not being open to further data, because you've already closed the whole box already. And this is a state that you American Western civilization is in as a whole. Yeah, writing about these subjects, these mystical occult subjects, I occasionally see coverage of them in the the mass media or the intellectual press, and the coverage is astonishingly bad. People like Blavatsky are criticized by people who obviously haven't read anything of her works. And this is something that would simply not be acceptable in any other discipline. But because the intelligentsia, kind of opting for this kind of skeptical or pseudo-skeptical mentality, knows the answer, it can treat these things in this incredibly cavalier way. So what you have is an enormous body of experience, human experience, that doesn't really fit very well into, the laws of thermodynamics. And you have an intellectual mindset today that doesn't really want to accept this. One of the most curious areas is parapsychological research. Parapsychological research is, well, can you do research into things like psychokinesis, basically moving things with your mind? Clairvoyance, being able to see something that isn't physically present, precognition, having some sense of the future that actually turns out to be accurate. And there has been an enormous amount of scientific work that's been replicated over the last 125 years. And surprisingly enough, science has proven that, there really are such things as psychokinesis and clairvoyance and precognition. A lot of experiments have been done. One of the earliest was basically a card guessing game. There were five cards, and they had funny little shapes on them, like crosses and diamonds and circles. And there was a big set of these cards, and they were shuffled randomly. And subjects were asked to guess which symbol was on the card. And their answers were, by and large, correct beyond statistical degree of, margin of error. And these experiments were replicated a lot. And they don't do them anymore. And the reason they don't do them anymore is that they're no longer interesting. We've done that enough, so why should we have to do that again? But if you believe the kind of the mainstream press, all of this stuff is bosh, and science is, science may not have disproven it, but it's just about disproven it, so we might as well just assume that it's disproven. Similar area has to do with the brain-mind question, which is a big issue. Is the brain the source of the mind? Is your mind, call it your soul if you like, purely a side effect of material processes? The answer that people are, many neurologists even, are pushing toward is, it basically is. Except that there are still these two things. There's the brain and there's consciousness. And how one actually arises out of the other has never been shown. They're always about to show it. They're always telling you they're going to show it very soon. But they may show it. I'm certainly not making any predictions, but they certainly haven't yet. One psychologist observed that the mind resembles the brain about as much as a telephone number resembles a person who has it. So there are a lot of questions there that are being begged, a lot of assumptions being made, and the supernatural, the paranormal kind of exists and kind of reminds us that all of these answers aren't so clear-cut, and that we don't know a great deal more than we do know. You know, I think you've all heard about dark matter and dark energy, which I don't really know what it is. I don't really think the physicists do either, but they've had to come up with it because it turns out, from various reasons, that the gravitational force of the universe is much larger than can be explained by the known quantity of matter. So there's this thing called dark matter and dark energy, about which we know nothing at present. It's useful from a theoretical point of view, but nobody knows anything about it. And then you have to ask yourselves, well, is this dark matter anything like the physical matter that we know? Well, it may well not be. Now, I think anyone would be, you know, any sort of intellectual person would probably be willing to admit that we just don't know a lot about this part of the universe. But you're begging again another big question when you assume that the human mind doesn't have some capacity for relating with this unknown aspect of reality, whatever it is, already. That is to say, to assume that what you can know is totally and 100% accounted for by the data of the five senses. And there's no reason to believe that's the case. The question is, do we have the capacity to perceive other realities apart from this? And that's, in a sense, one of the things that the supernatural, as a category, forces us to ask. Now, I certainly don't want to go on with and leave the impression that all of this kind of mystical stuff is totally and completely 100% valid and fascinating and true. As a matter of fact, I myself am fairly skeptical about one supposed area of a supernatural. And I have an article about an essay on it in this book. This is the book, by the way. Conveniently on sale at the table near the exit. The area I'm personally a bit skeptical about is prophecy. Because, you know, the records of prophets over the centuries just hasn't been too good. To take an example that's very fresh in mind, for some project I've been working on a freelance basis, I happened to look, you know, about 45 minutes ago at this section of the book of Ezekiel. And in this section of the book of Ezekiel, Ezekiel the prophet predicts that the king of Babylon will destroy the city of Tyre. You know, he will smash down your walls and, you know, lay you waste and, you know all the good Bible stuff. Well, if you page a couple of chapters down in the book of Ezekiel, you get a later thing where kind of he sort of more or less has to admit that the king of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, never conquered the city of Tyre. He laid siege to it for 13 years, and because it was a half mile offshore, he could just never really get to it. And curiously enough, I mean, if you look this up on the internet, you'll have, you know, all sorts of Bible prophecy sites saying, well, was the Bible wrong when it predicted that Nebuchadnezzar would lay waste to Tyre, which he never did? I didn't visit those sites, so I don't know what their answer is. But that's one example. Let's take another even more vivid, or a little better known example. The prophecies of Jesus. there's a little a section, it's called the Little Apocalypse, and it's in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21. These are more or less parallel to one another. And if you read that literally, you really have to come to the conclusion that Jesus believed that Jerusalem was going to be destroyed by the Romans and that this would precipitate the end of the world. If you just kind of read it at total. Now, part of it was right. The Romans did destroy Jerusalem in 70 AD, which is, you know, 40 years after Jesus' time. I mean, that's well known and well documented. And the Arch of Titus in Rome, which you can still see, commemorates it. That end of the world part, though, didn't quite really work out that way. It was the end of the Jewish world as it was then known, that's true. But it wasn't, you know, quite the cosmic event that was foreseen. And Christianity has had the problem ever since then of what are we going to do with this? And that set aside the book of Revelation, which is, you know, an even bigger can of worms, and we can go there if you like later on. What do they do about this? Well, every generation, Christianity, someone has predicted that the end of the world is going to come, you know, real soon, on a specific year. There's a website, which I don't know the name of offhand, but it basically has a list of all the years of the last 2000 in which somebody predicted the end of the world was going to come. And, you know, it's not quite all 2,000 years, but it's an enormous number of them. So you have to ask yourself, what use is this prophecy stuff? One of the essays in the book, and I wrote a separate book on the subject, was Nostradamus. What did Nostradamus predict? Well, there it becomes really murky, because he wrote in very, very obscure language, and language that you could make just about anything of, and just about everyone has. This is known as oracular language, the language of an oracle, which has lots of meanings to kind of cover the bases depending on what might happen. And Nostradamus did that fairly well. In his own weird way, his verses are kind of very broken and disjointed. They don't hold together very well. It's as if it's almost like a cubist painting. And I would say that the secret of Nostradamus's success is not so much that he was a good prophet, because his prophecies, if you get out to the extent that you can make something concrete of them, don't really hold up too well. But he was a great surrealist poet. And you can, you know, he does have this kind of vivid, bizarrely juxtaposed imagery, which was totally unlike the poetry of the time. I mean, it would fit better into 20th century poetry than it did into 16th century poetry, which is when he lived. So he had this uncanny ability to conjure up this sense of mystery. And, you know, needless to say, some of the things that he predicted sounded like things that later then happened. The most accurate prophecy that I remember of his, in which he predicts that Monaco, which was then, I think, belonged to Spain, would become a part of France, which, considering that Monaco is surrounded on all sides by France, except for the seashore, it doesn't require astonishing insight. Other things don't really pan out too well. One is a universal theme in this kind of a Christian prophecy that surfaced since the fall of the Roman Empire, which was the coming of a universal Christian monarch who would sort of lay waste all God's enemies and sort of, you know, bring, you know, an era of peace and prosperity. This is not in the Bible. It only kind of arose out of the Roman Empire falling and people, you know, wishing it, you know, hadn't fallen. Nostradamus has that too, and it can be convenient if you're a prophet to hint that the king of your particular country at that particular time might well be this universal Christian monarch, and that's exactly what Nostradamus did. But the monarchs, the kings of France in Nostradamus's time are not anything too remarkable, and you know, they certainly bore no resemblance to this, you know, great world leader that he predicted. There's Hister, a figure that Nostradamus mentions a lot. Well, not a lot, but you know, maybe in, I don't know, four or five of his quatrains, his four-line poems. And you can well imagine that in the 20th century, this would have been assumed to be Hitler. And remember, Hitler's propaganda secretary was named Josef Goebbels, and his wife Magda was fascinated by the occult and by Nostradamus, and sort of saw this and said, you know, wow, this is it. It's, you know, predicted the Führer. And whether her husband really believed it or not, he saw its incredible value for propaganda purposes. So during World War II, these books were published in neutral countries, you know, anonymously or kind of pseudonymously written, you know, hinting that guess who was going to win World War II? That was a use that was made of it. Well, who or what was Hister anyway? Well, Hister, or, you know, Ister, is an old name for the Danube River. And the Danube River is the principal river of Austria. And Austria was the most powerful nation, probably, in Europe in Nostradamus' time. So it would seem that Hister was really just his funny, oracular way of talking about Austria. But how exciting is that for you to hear? Well, he was really talking about the 16th century Habsburg Empire, which was a big deal in his day. Wrote up a story for, you know, some tabloid about that, people wouldn't do too much with it. It's just not that fascinating. So that's kind of some of the areas you get into when you kind of deal with prophecy. Sometimes he predicted things rather specifically, like he seemed to think, what was it, the eighth month of 1999 would come the great king of terror from the skies. And there was a lot of, you know, supposition about, you know, just what was going to happen in July or August of 99. Well, nothing really happened, as you remember. Lots of bad things have happened since then, but actually those months were pretty uneventful. And you go on and on and on. Another thing I cover in the book, which is fascinating for reasons that I don't think most people grasp, which is the 2012 phenomenon. You know, you all heard of the 2012 phenomenon, and you know, there was a movie about it, slicing through all of the verbiage, of which there's a great deal. The idea was that the Mayan calendar, which had this like 5,000-year cycle, was due to come to an end on December 21st, 2012. So you had all sorts of predictions and prophecies and expectations about this, ranging from, you know, the fact that it would literally mean the end of time, to the coming of the Space Brothers, to by George, that day we would wake up and every last 7 billion one of us would be enlightened, which I don't think happened.
Yeah, it did.
It did. We just don't know it. But I think that the 2012 phenomenon is still interesting because it says something really, it does mark a kind of watershed. And the watershed is this. Remember, I've been saying that there have been these apocalyptic predictions for, you know, year X, Y, and Z ever since the time of Christ. All of those were based on the Bible, usually some kind of really convoluted reading of Daniel and Ezekiel and Revelation sort of squashed together in some way that, you know, you and your followers found persuasive. But this one wasn't. This 2012 thing wasn't. It was based on a totally non-Christian myth, a totally non-Western myth. And it's interesting to see this apocalyptic, the survival of apocalyptic expectation, except that the old authorities don't, you know, if you just got it out of the book of Revelation, most people wouldn't care. What has the new authority? Well, indigenous wisdom, right? You know, the wisdom of native peoples obviously has a lot more authority for a good number of people than, you know, the texts of Christianity. And that is interesting. That is interesting. It does, I mean, you can see, in a sense, kind of a Christian apocalyptic mentality is kind of going forward on inertia. But civilization has detached itself from the original myth enough so that it attaches it to something completely different. That's to say, the Mayan prophecy. So it really suggests that kind of the Judeo-Christian tradition has kind of lost its grip on a good part of the Western imagination. You know, are these religions, you know, going to cease to exist, you know, anytime soon? No, I don't think so. But there does seem to be this real watershed of time when belief in those traditions are, on a civilization-wide basis, is crumbling, for better or for worse. So these are, in a sense, all the negative things to say about prophecy. Things predicted on a kind of world basis, you know, it hasn't been that great. Astrologers' records are pretty spotty. I saw a column that said, took a survey of astrological predictions for the last election, and according to the survey, 31 astrologers predicted that Obama would win, and 14 predicted that Romney would win. Well, that sounds all right, I guess. I mean, you really have to wonder what percentage of those astrologers wanted Obama to win, you know, and how you would factor that out of the whole thing. What percentage of those astrologers voted for Obama? Well, maybe at least, you know, it probably 2-1 astrologers went for Obama. It's probably more or less the way it worked. So what authority, you know, but I did say that there does seem to be this thing called precognition. In my own reading of the whole thing, precognition seems to work best, you know. Sometimes you need to know something and you're told it for you individually, personally. This doesn't always happen because people are surprised by it, but every now and then there's something you need to know about before it's going to happen, and something tugs you on the shoulder and gives you some sort of hint, whether it's a dream or a flash of intuition or whatever. My own personal view and experience is that kind of thing, you know, has a lot more validity than these grand scale prophecies, which are, you know, making all sorts of sweeping claims about, you know, continents falling into the sea and so on. Although that particular thing is less incredible now than it was 50 years ago, as global warming continues to rise. One of the essays in the book is on Atlantis, and the myth of Atlantis goes back to Plato. He was the first person who wrote about it. And not to go into too much detail about it, he said that this information came from Egypt, where they've been keeping records and, for thousands of years, and that Atlantis sank in 9600 BC. That's, I can explain why it's kind of calculated that way, but I won't. You know, that is kind of around the end of the last ice age. And we do know that during the last ice age, there was a lot of land that was above water that isn't anymore. So, you know, there's going back to the scientific benchmark, if you want to go there, there's really nothing particularly impossible about the idea that there was a relatively advanced civilization someplace, maybe just outside the Straits of Gibraltar, which is where Plato said it was. There are actually formations there that might have been above water at a certain point around then. May well have happened. The weird thing about, I mean, Plato's description of Atlantis is kind of very geometric, and it's in a sense kind of has his own kind of sacred geometry written into it, which is very hard to figure out. But one thing that wasn't a myth was he said a very odd thing about Atlantis. He said, it's the gateway to the continent beyond, which is this, you know, could really be said to be a limitless continent. So this tradition not only had the story about Atlantis sinking, but there was a tradition, that there was another huge continent on the other side of the ocean. That certainly makes you take it a little more seriously. The ancient civilizations, like a lot of things in this area, are kind of like Rorschach blots. This is true of Egypt in a lot of ways. You know, when people start saying, you know, about the Great Pyramid and what it, you know, did and didn't do, you know, they're probably not really saying too much about the Great Pyramid, but they're probably saying a fair amount about, you know, their own expectations and beliefs about what ancient civilization was or should have been. All of that, I think, has to be factored into our dealing with these weird subjects. Another figure who's a Rorschach blot is Jesus. Because we don't know too much about Jesus historically. The Gospels are fairly selective in what they say about him, what they don't say about him. So, in a sense, we know just enough to project all sorts of things onto Jesus. And, you know, this has really taken off since the Da Vinci Code, which is another thing I write about in the book, you know, where Jesus was, you know, married to Mary Magdalene, and they had children, and these children went on to be the Merovingian kings of France, who stopped ruling France, like, around 700 AD. And that is all pretty wildly speculative, to say the least. But it, again, what's interesting about that is not so much whether it's factually true, which it probably isn't, but what is it actually saying? One of the things in Dan Brown's book that is kind of strongly highlighted is the resurgence of the divine feminine. The idea was that Mary Magdalene was kind of pretty much on a par with Jesus originally, in some kind of spiritual sense, and was eventually demoted in being this kind of repentant whore that you know, she became in Catholic hagiography. I think that's interesting, and it seems something like that seems to have happened. I mean, you know, Mary Magdalene, the Mary Magdalene who came to the tomb, and the Mary Magdalene who the Mary or the woman who was taken in adultery, like, are totally unconnected in the Gospels. They're found in the same chapter, but the fact that they're in the same chapter and they're not identified, you know, indicates that whoever wrote the Gospel of John just thought they were two different people and never connected them. It was only years later, centuries later, that that connection was made. The only things we know about Mary Magdalene from the, you know, any from the biblical tradition, there are only two real facts that anybody knows. One is that she was apparently the first person to find the empty tomb of Jesus, and that Jesus had cast seven devils out of her. Make of that what you will, but that's what it says. And that's all the Gospels really say about Mary Magdalene. So the creation of her as this repentant slut, creation of her as this kind of, you know, liberated equal to Jesus, are all, in a sense, kind of imaginative projections. And what the what that projection is at a given time tells us a lot about ourselves. There's certainly a lot in the in kind of New Age alternative literature that talks about this kind of resurgence of the divine feminine. And it's true that there are now gender-neutral versions of the Bible being published. You know, the status of women, you know, is certainly very, very different than it was 100 years ago. That's all true. Is there really a resurgence of the divine feminine? Or, because we don't really, I mean, everything that at least traditionally is equated with feminine values, rightly or wrongly, caring, compassion, nurturing, mothering, you know, so on, so on, cooking nice meals, are precisely the things that are increasingly devalued and increasingly scarce in our society. There's probably less, everything is more relentlessly economical, everything is more relentlessly materialistic. Caring, you know, where is that? You know, where is that on the bottom line? So, are we witnessing a resurgence of the divine feminine or a loss of these values in society and this kind of compensation by this longing for the divine feminine, the way you compensate in dreams? You know, if you're not really getting enough loving, you might have sexual dreams. A person who's, you know, in jail and eaten nothing but bad food for 10 years starts to dream about food. That's, you compensate. And this rebirth of the divine feminine may, since be a compensation for these really, you know, very real losses of value, these values in our society. I think that's worth taking seriously, at least as a consideration. So these are some of the aspects of the supernatural that, you know, I try to explore in the book. I suppose one last thing I might say is, and I think it's worth bringing up, is that the Russian philosopher P.D. Uspensky said that the miraculous is the laws of a higher plane manifesting on another, a lower plane. And I think there's something to this, assuming the miraculous does happen, which seems to every now and then. What does he mean by that? Well, you can look at it by thinking about the case of a dream of flying. A lot of people have had dreams about flying. And they're interesting and they're fun, but you know, no laws of the dream world are really being violated when you dream about flying. The world of dreams, which might be equated with what the Theosophists call the astral realm, has a different kind of set of realities and a different set of possibilities in the physical realm. That you can fly in a dream is nothing really all that special. If you were to fly in the physical level, that is to say, if these laws of the astral level were made manifest the physical level, that would be a miracle. And again, supposedly that does happen. I mean, the Catholics have a tradition of levitating saints, and the TM movement for a while was trying to show, with whatever degree of success, that if you just meditated their way long enough, you'd be able to levitate, but that may not have panned out. And I think that's, you know, maybe the final point I kind of want to make about the supernatural is that there are these other realms, and they are explored. It can be explored in very fairly systematic and disciplined ways. A lot of it has become popularized, a creative visualization, talking to dream characters. You remember there was kind of a bit of a furor about Jean Houston. It's like a well-known New Age writer and thing. And she became friendly with the Clintons. And there was this brouhaha because she did some sort of, you know, workshop with the Clintons. And the idea leaked out that Hillary Clinton thought she was talking to Eleanor Roosevelt. Did Hillary Clinton think she was talking to Eleanor Roosevelt? I doubt it. But I imagine that Eleanor Roosevelt was kind of a very powerful figure in Hillary Clinton's mind, and the whole purpose of this exercise was to have her, as they say, dialogue with this figure. Now that's something out of, among other things, Gestalt psychology. You know, sometimes you're you, and then there's the part of yourself that you hate, and you know, they have you sit in one chair and be you and talk to the other person about part of yourself that you hate. Then you go and you have the other person, part of yourself that you hate, and you talk back, and it's, you know, is this really schizophrenia? I mean, no, it isn't really. It's just a useful exercise. And this is just a way of starting to explore these realms. There do seem to be times when it veers into the supernatural. And the psychologist Jung started having this dream, this inner figure called Philemon. That was the name he gave it. And this Philemon was kind of like a Gnostic teacher from antiquity. And this figure of Philemon started to take on his own reality and started to say, you know, say things that, you know, Jung didn't himself consciously know. And then you find yourself asking, well, you know, is this really a contact with another entity from beyond? Or is it just like a figure of my imagination? There is an awful lot of human experience that suggests that there's some sort of interaction with the spirit realm, the unseen, invisible worlds is not only possible, but sort of, you know, has happened and been done on a regular basis. And this evidence, this is, you know, an enormous body of experience that embraces like most of world cultures, you know, most of the time. The elements of, you know, the civilizations and pieces of civilizations that haven't believed in this stuff have actually been, you know, really ours, you know, maybe for the last 400 years, not too many others. And then you finally find yourself asking, well, does what happened to us depend on what we believe? And I don't mean individually. You know, your thoughts, you know, if you think positive things will happen to you. Everybody knows that, you know, stuff. But what if we live in if our civilization is kind of like a realm of thought, and what happens to us is very, very strongly conditioned, not only by our own beliefs, but by the beliefs of everybody around us. I think you can take that in interesting directions. It would explain, for example, why curses would seem to work in certain cultures. Now, the official view of curses is, well, it's just sort of a suggestion. The person believes he's cursed, and he thinks he's cursed, so he gets sick. Well, there's one problem with that, is that, you know, if you're like a real witch doctor and you put a curse on someone, you don't want them to know about it. Because then they would get another witch doctor and counteract it and, you know, do that. The idea is they don't know about it. So it can't really be suggestion in the sense that we're talking about. But is it to some extent conditioned by the fact that you're living in a tribe or a culture or whatever that, you know, believes in curses? We don't probably tend to see curses happening a lot in our kind of middle class lives. But is that because we inhabit kind of a world of thought in which curses just don't happen? Does that create kind of a structure not only for what we think is reality, but what we actually experience? So I think I'll stop there. We have, you know, certainly some time for discussion and questions, so I will open it up.
Well, in general, are you a skeptic when it comes to the supernatural? I sense that maybe you have a healthy skepticism, but I guess my question is a little bit unclear because mm-hmm. I really was unclear about your own attitude about the supernatural. Mm-hmm. Other than you have maybe you're open to it, but you have a healthy skepticism. I don't know.
Yeah. That's the case. I mean, my attitude toward it is, I mean, I definitely think these realities are there. The problem is sometimes the more you look for them, the more they seem to elude you. So I'm not a skeptic in that sense. I think there's a lot that has to be viewed with skepticism. So I'd be willing to say, well, you know, I really don't think prophecy is terribly, really been terribly successful over the last 2,500 years. At the same time, yeah, the possibility of precognition does seem very real and does obviously seem to happen. So it's not total disbelief. It's not total belief. Sometimes in esoteric schools, there's a maxim you hear called neither accept nor reject. And just that frame of mind can be kind of helpful in this. If only because it's the fact that it's liberating. Well, do I really know X, Y, Z? No, I don't really know X, Y, and Z as such. I do know what's happened to me. That's why I started with those two stories of my own experience. Yeah, okay, yeah, that happened to me. Both of those had an element of the supernatural about them. But when it starts coming to, you know, other people's, you know, elaborate descriptions of alternate realities, I have to say, you know, to a certain extent, I don't know. Some of them sound more authentic than others. So I think something like a healthy open-mindedness, as a friend of mine says, you know, always keep a good working crap detector would be my attitude.
Richard, beyond what you've written in your own book, what are books or authors that you would recommend that you have found useful in exploring this area?
That's a good one. There are a lot of them. They're a fairly uneven collection. Books on the occult written a few generations ago tended to make much more grandiose claims than I think people would be willing to do today. That includes, you know, a lot of the theosophical literature. I'm trying to think what books have I found useful. Well, I mentioned Uspensky, and his book In Search of the Miraculous is which is kind of his time with G.I. Gurdjieff, whom I've spoken about here. Certainly a very powerful book. A friend of mine in England wrote a book on ritual magic called Wielding Power, which isn't terribly well known, but I think is very good. Among the better works kind of on this whole subject are those of Dion Fortune, who that was a pen name of the magical motto of an English woman named Violet Firth, who died in 1946. Warren Kenton, who's a friend of mine, writes under the name Zev Ben Shimon Halevi, done a number of books on the Kabbalah that I think are very good. So those are some of the ones that come to mind.
A couple of things. When you talked about the consciousness of the people around you affecting what you might think, and doesn't that fit in with Jung's collective unconscious that he felt was affecting humanity? And when he traveled around the world, he found archetypal figures in primitive cultures here, there, and everywhere that had no connection with each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned Rolling Thunder in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me, I mean, I read the book about Rolling Thunder that came out years ago, which I found absolutely fascinating, which mm-hmm. goes more into he as an Indian shaman and the mm-hmm. things that he could accomplish. And, mm-hmm. and the book was written by a journalist who saw him do some miraculous things mm-hmm. in healing sessions
mm-hmm.
that then he gave up his journalistic career mm-hmm. just to live with Rolling Thunder for a year. So that's a fascinating book to read
yeah.
on this.
Yeah. Doug Boyd, I think.
Yes,
the author.
Yes.
Yeah, that is. He was an amazing guy. I mean, I visited him in 1991 when he was kind of old, and he was suffering badly from diabetes. Suffering to the extent that, you know, he'd had at least one leg amputated, that kind of thing. But there was a kind of a real sense of power around him. That kind of thing has lived on in, you know, certain corners of the, you know, American Indian tradition. There's a guy named Russell Four Eagles who practices up in Spooner, Wisconsin, who has that kind of same element of magic about him. Where Quest Books is publishing a book of his that'll probably be out next year, which is kind of his personal story. Going back to the first question, what I was talking about is maybe a little different from Jung's concept of the collective unconscious, in that what he's talking about, the collective unconscious, he really means it's universal.
Yeah.
You know, there are these trickster figures, hero figures, wise old man figures, so on, in, you know, that pop up everywhere, and these are really universal. And he says that they're really parts of manifestations of the structure of the psyche.
Mm.
When I was talking about that particular aspect of the question, I was thinking more in terms of collective belief and kind of collective assumptions. And maybe collective hallucinations. It's not. It's in another book of mine, The Dice Game of Shiva, which I reproduce a story about the Indian rope trick. The Indian rope trick is famous, and there are not many people who can do it. But this parapsychologist, you know, found some guy who was willing to do it. So he got an audience together, and he got his assistant, and what he did is he threw a rope up in the air. His assistant climbed up the rope, vanished, and started throwing parts of his body down on the ground. And then he climbed down completely, the assistant then climbed down completely unharmed. Now, a couple of hundred people saw this. They basically agreed on what they saw. But someone put a camera there. And what the camera recorded was the master and his student just sort of standing there doing absolutely nothing during that whole time. I mean, I think, you know, in the theosophical literature, Blavatsky calls that a maya, which is an illusion. And how does that work? It's not a, you know, it's not just you, it's like everybody. So if that kind of thing can take hold, you know, of a small group of people in reasonably limited circumstances, what must, say, the collective belief of a civilization do to all of us who are, I mean, we're immersed in it. You know, I mean, we're told what's real and what's not real from childhood up. If you have an imaginary friend in our society, if you have a child, you're told this imaginary friend is doesn't exist. You know, it's just really something in your head. If you were in another, maybe if you lived in rural Ireland or something like that, they might have a slightly different attitude toward these imaginary friends. And the reality would seem different. That's more of what I was talking about. And it's a very, very subtle issue, and I don't think it's well understood. The only book I've ever read that sort of relates to it is an obscure book called Collective Reflexology by a Russian psychologist named Bekhterev. He lived during the Russian Revolution, and he witnessed a lot of people just going crazy en masse for no particular reason in the streets. And he concocted this theory that moods, even attitudes, might almost be like kind of electric signals that literally move from brain to brain. That was his theory, and make of it what you will. I think he is one of the few people who actually tried to deal with this issue of collective psychology and mass psychology. You know, and then what do you do with a country like Nazi Germany, where at some collective level there was like a profound sickness. But a lot of the people, you know, kind of the personal level, probably didn't seem that sick. They went to their jobs, they did, you know, they had their families, they tried to do that. So is there a level of the collective mind that can be diseased, even though the conscious, personal level of the mind isn't? I mean, I think, you know, if you, like, read a lot of history, I mean, I think you find yourself being forced to ask this question anyway. Anyway, those are some thoughts on that.
One more question.
I wonder if you could say something about the use of drugs in this. I guess I read somewhere where Harvard or Yale or somebody had discontinued all their testing on LSD and things like that. I wondered why. And I also remember reading books by Carlos Castaneda. Mm-hmm. And wondered where that, you know, I forget what it's called when you can just move from one space to another. Mm-hmm. Was just interesting. Now, is that considered a cult?
Well, you'd certainly think so. That, you know, is a subject in and of itself for a lecture or a book. I mean, there are a few things I can say about it. These chemicals do seem to, you know, stimulate some pretty amazing experiences. Rightly or wrongly, these experiences are viewed with a lot of suspicion. So if you had a sense of seeing God while you're on acid, and told someone that, well, you're just high. You might even discount it yourself. Would it be that different from, you know, having like a spontaneous mystical experience in a state of prayer? I don't know. Not, you know, quite possibly not. So that's always kind of a question you have to ask about, and that always is asked about kind of the whole drug experience, like, you know, just the fact that it's a drug make it illegitimate. Going back to what you first said, the reason the university stopped studying the stuff in the 1960s was that it became illegal. There was kind of an active subculture of artists and intellectuals and psychologists in the 50s and 60s that were starting to use materials like LSD and mescaline, getting some interesting experiences out of them. Aldous Huxley wrote a famous book called The Doors of Perception, which talks about his experiences on mescaline. And all the stuff was perfect. The stuff was perfectly legal. There was no, there was no law against it. Arguably, you could say that Timothy Leary sort of went so far in kind of proselytizing it that it caused a backlash and got it banned, because it was banned. LSD was banned in 1967. I don't know about mescaline. I don't know what year mescaline was banned, but that's why they stopped studying it. And you know, a little secret that is almost never discussed. But there's an active subculture of psychotherapists who still use things like, you know, LSD and ecstasy, and in therapeutic work with patients, and found it very valuable. It goes without saying these people are not advertising their services in the phone book. And I think, you know, society's really not, you know, it's still kind of coping with its kind of pharmacology. Because, I mean, we've learned so much about the brain. And it's not really, you know, just, I mean, we've just, you know, the use of chemicals for psychological problems, you know, has increased enormously. You know, antidepressants being kind of the most famous and obvious example. It does seem that there's a kind of qualitative difference between the more synthetic psychedelic materials like LSD and ecstasy, as opposed to the more plant-based ones like peyote. There's a substance called ayahuasca. I don't know if anyone's heard of ayahuasca. I know some of you have, which is it's kind of this thick drink made out of the juice of a couple of plants that they mix together in a certain sort of way, and leads to visions. And you know, it has its own kind of subculture. People go down the jungle just to use ayahuasca. Those seem to have a slightly different quality. Of course, their advocates, you know, assume that they're better because they're natural. I don't know that I know that. But the most famous study of this whole issue was a very, very widely reproduced academic article by Houston Smith, who's well known as the author of World's Religions. You know, he's changed the title a couple of times. And, you know, he did this, there was this experiment, you know, with, divinity students. I think it was called the Good Friday Experiment. It took place around 1963. And, you know, it gave all these seminary students, some LSD and just to see what would happen. I don't remember the findings very specifically, but Houston Smith's own conclusion was, and he more or less put it this way, if drugs can produce religious experiences, it's less clear that they, or can produce spiritual experiences, it's less clear that they can produce spiritual lives. And there's always this, you know, and it is a problem with any sort of ecstasy. I mean, I don't mean the drug, but any kind of ecstatic experience. Well, you know, you still have to, what are you going to do with it now? I mean, you still got bills to pay and, dishes to wash and that kind of thing. You know, how do you integrate these peak experiences? You're right about it. Right about it. Well, that's one way of doing it. Some people paint about it, some people do music. So are we about
Yeah. Thank you, Richard. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Good. Thank you. It was a real pleasure.